is Las Vegas Weekly's Radio Mag on KUNV. I'm Sarah Felberg, editor of Las Vegas Weekly. And on tonight's show, we are doing something really scary. No, we're not going live or letting our director Ryan Olbrich take over the show. We are talking about contagion. And we are talking about what would happen if a fatal disease was spreading in Las Vegas. Managing editor Spencer Patterson is here with me. But before we get started, let's listen to a clip from Contagion.
Is there anyone else who might have had contact with her?
This was everyone.
Aaron Barnes did.
Barnes, he worked on another floor.
There were documents she needed to sign. He picked her up from the airport.
He picked her up from the airport?
Yes.
Where is he?
Hello?
Hello? Mr. Barnes?
Yes.
This is Dr. Mears from the Centers for Disease Control. I believe you may have had contact with Beth Emhoff last week.
Yeah, I picked her up at the airport. What's this about?
How are you feeling today?
Pretty cruddy, to be honest. Head is pounding. I probably picked up some sort of bug.
Where are you right now?
I'm on the bus, heading to work.
I'd like you to get off immediately.
Wait, what? What's going on?
Where's
the bus, Aaron?
Lake and Lindale. Can you tell me what's
Lake
going on?
Lake and Lindale. I really need you to get off that bus. Listen, it's quite possible you've come in contact with an infectious disease and that you're highly contagious.
Wait,
do you understand? I want you to
okay.
get off now and
I'm
stay
off.
Away from other people.
No, what do I do?
Don't talk to anyone. Don't touch anyone. That's the most important thing.
So that was a clip from Contagion.
Now, I haven't seen the movie, but I've got to say I'm already kind of scared about what's going on there.
Yeah, you know, I love infectious disease movies. I'm a big fan of Outbreak, and this movie is scary. It's really realistic, and that's the scariest part of all.
Now, I've been sick the last couple of weeks, so I think that's playing into it a little bit. Just hearing that makes me wonder what I've got.
Of course. Well, hopefully not what the people in Contagion
right.
had.
I'm pretty sure I don't. Now, you watched the movie, you saw the movie, and then you thought of an idea for a story. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, during the movie, one of the lines that really stuck with me was that same doctor, Dr. Mears, and she's in a meeting with health department people, I think in Minnesota, and she's saying some statistics about how diseases spread. And she says the average person touches their face, I want to say 2 to 3 times per minute. And in between, they're touching objects, doorknobs, other people, all different things. And I was watching the movie and it made me start thinking about myself and how often I was touching my face. And I kind of sat there and put my hands in my lap and tried really, really hard not to touch my face for the rest of the movie. And of course, I failed miserably. And on the way out of the theater, I was trying so hard not to touch anything else. I didn't want to touch the railings. I didn't want to touch the door handles. It had me definitely freaked out a little bit about what could be on those railings and door handles.
I'm guessing you weren't the only one. I'm sure everyone that saw that movie probably had that kind of reaction. They suddenly realized all the different ways they could, you know, transfer something to their mouth or their nose or their eyes.
Exactly. Yeah, the transfer of disease is really easy. And that really got me thinking because in the movie, the actual disease outbreak is transferred through objects. And, you know, different organisms can live on a static object for different periods of time. And it got me thinking about Las Vegas, where we all are in such close contact with each other, particularly on the Strip. And there's lots of tourists there all the time touching the same things, you know, touching restaurant tables and slot machines and poker chips. And I wondered to myself, what would an infectious disease do in a city like Las Vegas?
Right. So that got you thinking about talking to some people who know a lot about this, some experts around town.
Yeah. And I immediately reached out to the Southern Nevada Health District and they had a lot to say about it. I always kind of think when you have a Hollywood version of something and you call the actual professional that they're going to kind of put your mind at ease and say, oh, this was overdone and overblown. And that is not what happened in this case.
Right. I've read your story and that's not what happened.
That's not what happened at all. In fact, when I talked to Nancy Gerken, who's a training officer in the Office of Preparedness at the Health District, she had seen the movie as well and really liked it because she said it was so accurate. She said, you know, there were a couple things in the movie that she felt had been sort of Hollywoodized and were a little bit over the top. But in general, she said the spread of the disease and its kind of strength and potency was actually really realistic.
Did anybody say whether Las Vegas would be more prone to actually be a spot where this could, you know, spread more quickly than other cities?
Yeah, I mean, the important thing to remember, of course, is that there are diseases spreading all the time here, which is kind of a scary thing to think about. I talked to Brian Labus, who is a senior epidemiologist with the health district, and he really said that there are outbreaks happening constantly. It's, you know, flu outbreaks or a stomach flu or a respiratory illness, and most of them pass through the city and people get sick and then they get better, and we never even hear about it in the public, but the health department is dealing with it all the time. And the thing that's really intense about contagion is, of course, the disease is a lot scarier than getting the stomach flu and feeling kind of queasy for a couple days. It's a disease that kills, you know, an incredible amount of people, and that doesn't happen that often. But Las Vegas is more prone to spreading any disease, whether it's flu or something more serious, just because of the number of people in such close proximity to each other.
And the number of people coming from all over. I mean, if a disease was to start almost anywhere, inevitably someone from that place would probably pass through here.
Exactly.
You know, sometime soon.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. In the movie, the disease, I won't tell you where exactly, but the disease starts in Asia. And I feel like Asia gets blamed for a lot of infectious diseases in movies and in pop culture. And I asked a bunch of people, you know, is Asia really getting the short end of the stick here? Why do we keep blaming them? And they said, you know, actually, no, they kind of deserve some of that, mostly because a lot of the really scary diseases out there have actually come from animals. And in parts of the world, particularly Asia and Africa, where people live in closer proximity to their livestock, there is a higher likelihood of an animal disease like a swine flu or an avian flu getting transferred to humans and then mutating in a way where it can transfer from human to human. And that's the really scary stuff out there, as far as I know, because it can be stuff that we don't know about and we don't know how to deal with. There's a lot of infectious diseases out there, measles, mumps, smallpox, that essentially don't even exist anymore because people got really sick and died and we learned how to deal with it and now we vaccinate. But if something comes around and there's no cure and no vaccine, we're in a tight spot.
Right. And of course, we have a high number of tourists coming in from Asian nations. So
certainly.
That would put us at risk.
The other thing people said that I thought was really interesting and made a lot of sense was that airplanes are really actually the worst possible place for infectious disease transmission, because the air in an airplane is just recirculating again and again and again. So if you have someone who's sick, who's coughing into the air, those, you know, droplets are just circulating in the air and have a lot of potential to get somebody else sick. One of the people I talked to, who was absolutely fascinating, was actually a UNLV political science professor named Dennis Paragis, who studies globalization and pandemics as part of that. And he said that whenever he flies, he always brings along a little mask for himself to wear, like a surgical mask. And he doesn't always wear it. But if the person behind him or the person in front of him or next to him is coughing, he'll put it on just as a precaution, just to make himself feel a little bit safer if they're not wearing one.
Does that actually provide any kind of protection, or is it more just, like you said, just to make himself feel like it's offering,
you know,
protection?
I think it does actually provide some serious protection. If you're not getting in contact physically with it, a lot of these things pass through bodily fluids, like, you know, mucus or saliva potentially. And so if you have something blocking that transmission, you might not get sick from that particular organism.
Of course, you're going to scare everybody else on the plane into thinking there's a problem.
Very, very true. And the planes are, I mean, planes and globalization are really an interesting part of the whole outbreak kind of issue that's going on in the world, because it used to be, if a disease was going to spread, it would spread on a boat. You know, a rat would get on a ship and travel from China to London or something like that. And it would take a really long time for a disease to spread, because it just took a long time for people and animals to move across the world. And now, as Nancy Gerken from the Southern Nevada Health District reminded me, you can get on a plane and be anywhere in the world in 24 hours. And you can pick up anything there and bring it back to Las Vegas or Chicago or wherever in the world you're going, and spread it around when you get home.
So given all this, I mean, does Las Vegas have any kind of special preparedness plan, more so than maybe any other city would?
You know, we basically do the same things that most cities do. When I talked to Brian, the epidemiologist, he mentioned, you know, that we have learned from other cities that have had outbreaks around the world. And a lot of these we might not necessarily hear about in the U.S. if it's a fairly contained outbreak in, you know, somewhere small, a small town in Africa or something like that. But we can learn. We can learn from those how to deal with them and what kind of steps to take. And there's the most important steps are really precautionary, preventative steps. And one of the things that he and his coworkers do is something that he called disease surveillance that I thought was really, really interesting. And that's monitoring, essentially. It's just keeping track of what diseases are out there and making sure that they know if there's a different strange strain of flu in town, they'll get samples from local doctors' offices. And if something that looks a little more serious pops up on the radar, a health provider will call their office and report it and say, hey, we've got a potential, you know, smallpox case or tuberculosis case or something's come in the office that's scaring us a little bit. You should know about it. And they manage to keep track really, really well of what's going on in town and dealing with it pretty quickly.
Now, you mentioned the mask. Is there anything else? Did anybody mention any other ways that individuals can protect themselves just in general from, you know, even the flu or anything more serious should it ever come along?
Sure. Well, Nancy Gherkin really stressed the basics. And I thought this was so funny because when you think of fighting infectious disease, you don't necessarily think of doing simple things like just washing your hands a lot. And she said, really, the basic standards are the most important, and it's washing your hands with soap and water. She suggested singing Row, Row, Row Your Boat while you do it, because to wash your hands properly and dry them apparently takes about the same length of time as it does to sing Row, Row, Row Your Boat. One of our staff members sang it really, really fast and was like, look, I'm done. But that is not how you're supposed to sing it. If you sing it double time, you have to sing it twice. So that's a big step. And then the other steps are, you know, covering your mouth when you cough or sneeze, trying not to spread something. And then the most important one, probably, that people forget is if you're really sick and you're not being treated by a doctor yet, stay home. Don't go out to work. Definitely don't go to like a movie theater or a mall or like a crowded place and like go cough on everybody around you, because you'll be spreading a disease then and you have the potential to infect a lot of people, although it'll probably be with something fairly minor. Stay home. And she brought up the fact that with the economy the way it is, that's been a serious problem, is that some people, if they don't have sick time built into their schedule or if they don't have any PTO time left, they really feel like they have to go to work no matter what. So when they're getting sick, they really feel like they can't stay home and they're showing up at the office anyway, and then they're getting sick and they're getting their coworkers sick.
I can see that for sure.
Spencer.
Yeah, well, I stayed home for a couple of days while I was sick. So
you did.
I did the right
did.
Thing.
Yes.
All right, well, I think maybe we're out of time and ready for our second segment, so I'm going to run off and wash my hands now right away. I feel the need to do that now.
And go see Contagion. It's a really fun movie. Definitely, yeah. You know, check it out and then try to wash your hands a lot afterwards.
Maybe I'll see it when I'm feeling better.
Sounds good. Thanks so much. Welcome back to Las Vegas Weekly's Radio Mag on KUNV. I'm Sarah Felberg, editor of Las Vegas Weekly. And joining me now is reporter, blogger extraordinaire, John Katzlamitis. And we're going to talk about something near and dear to the hearts of many Las Vegans, the ad campaign, What Happens Here Stays Here. And the ad campaign is actually up for an award this week in New York City. So let's hear a little bit about where this came from and how it's doing in the runnings.
Hello, Feldy.
Thanks so much for joining me, John.
It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
I sit 5 feet from you at work, and this is kind of a special moment because I'm sitting here
and
doing
radio
together.
Headphones.
We're wearing headphones, and it's very, very romantic. It's very cool. let's see here. We're talking what happens here stays here.
Yes.
And I remember when this campaign was launched, they put it out, and the first couple of commercials were brought into our office on, I think they were on DVD. They might have even been on VHS.
This was at the back time, in the...
In 2001.
Yes.
In the fall. And the first one that I saw was the one where the women were laughing in the limousine.
Take us through that.
It's a bachelorette party, and there's one woman who's not the bachelorette, who's part of the party, and they're all kind of crammed haphazardly into a limousine, and one woman in the front is kind of the focus of attention, and the others start to laugh. They start to giggle a little bit, and everybody starts laughing, and it's kind of a ripple through the limousine. And finally, the woman who's the focus of all this, who had been kind of holding out, and she'd committed some transgression in public and some breach of protocol even by Las Vegas standards. And then she starts busting up, and that is the entire commercial, all these women laughing. And
there's no dialogue.
There's no dialogue. That is it. In a limousine, you see a little faint image of Las Vegas in the background, a little bit of neon. You know they're in Las Vegas. They're in the limousine. They're laughing. And it says, what happens here stays here. And your imagination takes over. And runs through that commercial. It's brilliant. That was the first one I saw. And then the next one was a woman who gets into a limousine. She's dressed in almost like club attire.
Sure.
That she's on her way to or from a club. And she's getting all over the limo driver and being flirty with him. And she loves the smell of the limo and all this. And then he puts the partition up. And when they finally get to the curb of the hotel where she's staying, she's dressed as a Midwestern mother, like a soccer mom is the best way to explain it. And she's talking to her kids on the cell phone. Oh yeah, mommy's having a good time. I'm on vacation. And it was what happens here stays here was again the tagline. Those are the first two I saw, and it was hilarious. And but even then, I don't think anybody had the idea that it would last this long and become such a force in pop culture and in advertising, and such an effective way to accurately brand this city.
It is, and I think the accuracy is so important.
Right.
It's right. It's so right. And I think for people who live here, I always joke, you know, what happens here stays here because I'm staying here. Mm-hmm. So it's not quite the same when you're local because you're not leaving, and those stories are staying right there with you.
You're in the middle of it, right? Yeah, I know. It's all fun and games until you can't leave. There's no outside. And what happens in Las Vegas, or what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, came later, and that was kind of a natural evolution of it for people who are not in Las Vegas talking about Las Vegas.
Sure.
So what happens there stays there, in other words. That was sort of unplanned, but the LVCVA has trademarked both phrases. I compare it to the slogan version of our Welcome to Las Vegas sign.
Yeah.
I think it is that. I really do believe that. And Jeff Candido and Jason Hoff, the two at the time mid-20s aged account executives, advertising writers at R&R, are like Betty Willis, who designed the Welcome to Las Vegas
sure.
sign. And that they put this together as part in the context of their job, and it just took off. And they've created something that is enduring well past their assignment.
And neither of them currently live in Las Vegas.
No.
They've both moved on to separate coasts.
Right.
Tell me about what the situation was like, the atmosphere, when they were actually creating this.
What happened was, you know, they weren't... they hadn't been in Las Vegas very long. They hadn't had much experience in their field for very long. They were very fresh-minded about what they were doing in the city. So they came in with an attitude like, what is exactly Las Vegas? Very unvarnished way of looking at the city. And the R&R had recently renewed its contract with the LVCVA to promote and market the city. They're the advertising arm of the LVCVA and the PR arm of the LVCVA. So these guys were charged by Billy Vasiliadis and Randy Snow at R&R to come up with an idea that would counter and run and would fly in the face of the campaign that had been the voice of which was Don Rickles talking about Las Vegas as being a family destination. And the idea had to be that you wanted to be not that in Las Vegas. That wasn't going to work.
Take family destination and
yeah,
180
it was,
degrees.
Yeah, that the family destination of Las Vegas lasted roughly 5 years. And
right.
the city did try to market, and the LVCVA did try to market the city that way, and it just didn't work. It wasn't what we were. And so they wanted to embrace what Las Vegas was actually like. And these guys started thinking about what it really was. And they said, there's all this stuff that happens. It's an adult playground. It's a place for grown-ups. Not like Triple X or anything. It's where the laws are the least. You have the most freedom, the least restrictive.
Sure.
And people can come here for 3 days and 2 nights and get a little nuts, and then leave and close the door behind them.
Right.
So they worked on that theme, and it became Randy Snow, and I think it was Jason Hoff had talked a little bit about it, what happens on the road stays on the road. And that's what I really remember, is that it was that theme, and that's like the traveling salesman. You know,
and it makes so much sense. I mean, looking back now, of course, hindsight is 20/20, but looking back now, it seems obvious that this was going to be a runaway success, that it really does capture the feeling of being in Las Vegas as a tourist when you're here and you kind of feel like you can get away with that dress that you would never wear at home, and you can flirt with a stranger at the bar, or, you know, stay out extra late, drink a little too much, and it's okay to do that. And, you know, you never do these things in your own hometown, but in Las Vegas, it's all right and no one needs to know.
Right.
But at the time, did people realize it was going to be so successful?
Well, I think that I think what was going on is that we inside Las Vegas, and this was true even then, are sometimes a little bit sensitive to that identity. You know, it's like we don't want to be seen as the place where the people who live here are crazy. You know, the people who come here get crazy, but we don't want them to think that about our city.
Right.
You know, what we want to show them really is that we're a place that's sort of normal. And that was what that campaign originally was about, the family. They were trying to remind people that, you know, people who are here have families. We like theme parks. We have Circus. We have the MGM Grand Adventure theme park, which was lousy. And the theme park in the middle of the summer that had no shade.
Ooh.
It was awful. And but we were trying to promote that and say, you know what, we have that kind of dexterity here. But the problem was it wasn't real. You know, it wasn't what the city was founded on. The city was founded on 24 hours of being able to have personal freedom as an adult. You can do all these other things, and you can have kids here, you know, and we have a community and all that. But for people to visit, what are we really? I mean, we're the people.
We are not Disneyland.
Right. No, we're not. If we're anything, we're what the cliche is, an adult Disneyland.
Right.
But it's a big people's theme park, and it's where you come to get a little crazy and go home. You know, and that was what they were trying to, they finally figured that out. But it took a while because a lot of our community leaders were kind of reluctant to do that. And also in the first set of commercials, in the earliest phases of this, none of our $1 billion resorts were shown in the commercial.
Ah,
so the people who invested all this money in the city are looking at our official approved advertising campaign, and you're like, where's my Bellagio? You know,
where's my marquee, right?
Yeah, where's, you know, what did I spend all this money and you're showing six women in a limousine? You know, this is not what I bought. This is not what the LVCVA, which draws its revenue from room taxes,
right,
is supposed to be doing. But it finally was sold. It was finally because the execution was so good. And Billy Vasiliadis, in the story that I wrote, as you know, because you edited it, has talked about how much hard research was done, hard secondary research all over the country, you know, in different demographics, talks about how this was vetted and made sure that by the time they got it out, it was going to be a winner.
Right.
They knew what they were doing.
I thought that was so interesting because you think of things like these as a light bulb going off and it sparks and everyone goes, ooh, brilliant. We just know it'll work. Mm-hmm. But that's not what happened here.
It really isn't. And it took me to talk to these guys directly because I felt that way too. They were walking along the strip together at 3 a.m. and all of a sudden one turns to the other and says, what happens here stays here. And then the clouds part and then Billy Vasiliadis shows up with angel wings. You know? But it's not that. It's all hard work. It's sitting in around the conference room and running through dozens of these ideas, dozens of themes on a similar idea. And then it takes somebody like Billy Vasiliadis to listen to the people around him, to understand what their concerns are, and then to test the market on those concerns and to put a version of the commercial out without the phrase. They did that.
Really?
They tried this out without, with just the only in Vegas tagline, which is on every one of them anyway. And then they showed all of these test marketed audiences, the one with what happens here stays here, and they liked the what happens here stays here consistently every time more than the other one.
It's hard to even imagine them without the tagline.
It doesn't make any sense. Yeah, I mean, you have to have it there. It's something that kicks off the entire The entire campaign. And you get to the point where somebody like Laura Bush, as Billy Vassiliadis said, says it on The Tonight Show.
Right.
You're home free. Really, you can't buy that.
You've arrived.
You know, it's like, just let's just keep rolling it out. You know, and one thing that's not in the story is that Vassiliadis almost has to bite the bullet because he's a guy who's used to creating more and more ideas.
Yeah.
You know, this is like the hit you keep having to play because the audience loves it. But again, the audience loves it, so why... You have to play it.
Exactly. Know? Yeah. You don't really have a choice at a certain
point. It was a really
point.
Fun story to work on, though. It was really fun for a lot of reasons. Yeah.
And we wrote a story in the Weekly. This was about, I want to say, 2 months ago or so. April Corbin wrote just a short story. She had seen a commercial, a fairly awful commercial, and involved like babies trying to poop into diapers or something ridiculous. And the tagline was, "What happens in diapers stays in diapers." And it was just the most ridiculous extrapolation of our city's tagline. And I have to say, I was a little bit offended. I was like, how dare you take it to that level?
Yeah, that is probably the lowest level I've heard of it. And I don't think you can get much lower than that than baby poop.
Yeah, you know, seriously.
To use as a depiction of this campaign. But it's been used, and as I said in a story, that, to kick off the story, that it was derived itself. That what happens here stays here. It was derivative unintentionally, but Candido was out on vacation with his wife, Sophie, after all these had been produced, but before they came out, and he saw a shirt said, "What happens in Lake Havasu stays in Lake Havasu." And he said it was nervous breakdown time,
yeah,
because that unwinds the whole thing. If you think you're infringing on trademark, you got to take it away. You know, it can't run. And if they had acted on that, he decided not to tell anybody.
And this is probably, in your story, is the first time that we've heard that story publicly. Is that right?
For sure, that one. There's a lot of little nuggets in there that I was unaware of. Or I'd heard maybe secondhand and verified. Billy Vassiliadis' wife didn't like the campaign. Jan Jones didn't like the campaign.
The mayor at the time
was not a fan of it. Those are instances where finally now you can kind of tell the tale. You know, it's like, okay, this is the 10th year for it to air nationally. You can kind of, you know, talk a little bit with a little bit more freedom about it than you could before, because you're pretty much home free now with it.
And what about the two guys who worked on it? I mean, where are they now, and how do you follow something like that up?
Well, they're Candido works for Deutsch in LA. It's an advertising firm, and Jason Hoff works for an agency in New York, and it's called RE, I think. And they're both high-ranking, high-powered advertising writers and development and creative people. And they have both said that they try to ward against what for lack of a better term, is the one-hit wonder syndrome.
Right.
You know, it's like sometimes like a kid Clint Holmes about having a playground in my mind is your one
sure.
hit. You know? And they said that in both cases, they are aware of it. They don't want to ever be complacent in their career because of it. And but they also recognize that it might be impossible to duplicate that type of success in that way. I mean, they're only in their mid-30s. I think they're both 35 years old now. So they have a lot of territory to cover in their careers. I mean, you know, they have another maybe 30-year career going. And to know that you've kind of reached your creative peak or the moment of creative success that won't be duplicated in your mid-20s.
That's a terrifying idea.
It is pretty daunting, but it is them. It is theirs, and people respond to it, and they own it.
They do own it.
Creatively, they own it.
And we kind of own it as a city. Do you think we'll ever find a slogan that fits us better? I mean, are we going to outgrow it at a certain point?
I don't think we can outgrow it because it has so much interpretation value and has so much potential for interpretation. It's a singular phrase, but has unlimited use. You can, what happens here stays here. You can tell myriad tales about a visit to Las Vegas that matches it. You can just keep going and going and going. I think it'll stay
for... But if you tell the tales, then you've taken it out of the city.
That's right. Don't break the code. That's the next one. Know the code is the next campaign.
No tweeting, no Facebooking, no pictures.
Twitter's going to be the death of us all, right?
And on that note, follow John Katzlamitis on Twitter at...
I'm at Johnny Katz.
And you can follow me at Sarah Felberg. Thank you so much for joining
me,
John.
Yeah, it's great. Sarah, you're great.
And you can read John's full story in this week's issue of Las Vegas Weekly. Thank you to our producer, Steven Zeller. And listen next week, Thursdays at 5:30 p.m.